Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Past, Present, Future. Today's episode in our series about the history of freedom with the philosopher and writer Leah Ippie is about another philosopher, Immanuel Kant, and his ideas, his ideals for enlightened freedom and perpetual peace. We talk about just how realistic or unrealistic that ideal is, and about the limits of freedom of thought and freedom of expression. Past, Present, Future is brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books, and the LRB has got a brand new podcast. Out now, it's about the sinking of the General Belgrano, the bloodiest, the most controversial action of the Falklands War, and the diary that reveals what really happened. It's hosted by Andrew O'Hagan, and you can get it now. Just go to lrb.me/Belgrano or wherever you get your podcasts. Leah, Kant has a reputation as quite a difficult philosopher. Some of it is pretty difficult, I can testify to that. But he also says things that are really easy to grasp and quite intuitive. And I want to start with one of those. So there's a puzzle that Kant writes about that I think everyone will recognize, which is when you think about human freedom, there are two aspects of it that are hard to reconcile. So one is clearly to be a free human being is to be free to do whatever you like. At some level, to be human is to have the ability, unlike animals and other creatures, to make your own mind up. And if you are unconstrained, that could result in almost anything. The human brain is capable of coming to almost any decision or any choice. And yet, when you look at how human beings behave en masse, they tend to conform to certain patterns. They weirdly exercise their freedom in ways that makes it feel like they've all been told to do the same thing. So the example that I think of here, and I always think this every election time, when I watch the election coverage on the BBC or wherever it is, so people have voted in Britain, and however many it is, tens of millions of people vote. There have been opinion polls, but then on the night you discover what people actually have decided. And there's an exit poll. They asked a small number of people in various places. And this exit poll actually tells you how everybody voted. And it's incredibly accurate. And I find myself thinking, so just because these people in this part of the country have decided to do this, it's not like they told the people in the other part of the country to do the same thing, but they are going to do the same thing. There is going to be a pattern to this free exercise, unconstrained exercise of human choice. Because despite the fact that just because people in Yeovil have voted this way, people 50 miles down the road could have done something completely different, but they don't. They do the same thing. They maybe don't do what they said in the opinion polls they would do. They've exercised their freedom to make their own mind up on the day. But they've done the thing that the people 50 miles down the road did without having to be told. But it's almost as though what you do when you do the exit poll is you've asked the people who told all the other people how to vote, and it works. And that is what Kant is writing about. He's writing about this weird tension in human behavior between the obvious discretion that we have not to do what other people do and the fact that we do what other people do. And he has an answer for this. How come those two things are both true?
Yeah, and I think it's something to do with the nature of what we are as human beings. I think Kant thinks that reason is both disrupting a pattern and conforming to a pattern. Both of these are our capacities. And indeed, they're both our vulnerability. The kind of Achilles heel is that we have this, but they're also our strength. And in a way, the entire Kantian project, the entire critical project, is to be able to articulate an account of reason and how reason operates within humans that helps them think about their decisions and be aware of both the dangers and the promises of our use of our capacities. What I really like is, in many ways, the contemporary. There's a number of things that he says about humans, about reason, about our societies that are really resonant for today. And one of them is this tendency of reason to struggle with two things. One is dogmatism and one is skepticism. And the entire Kantian project and the project of reason is to help and to help us think through this. How can we avoid both dogmatism, that is to say conforming and accepting authority and endorsing what other people tell us, falling, complying into a pattern without questioning it. And on the other hand, skepticism, which is the opposite, to question everything and to then not have the resolve to do certain things because you're too questioning. And there's a kind of paralysis of action that leads. He thinks that the modern predicament is always torn between those two, and that it's only if you think about reason, his entire project is one that tries to help humans reason in such a way that they can steer a middle path between these two things, dogmatism and skepticism. And I think that's really resonant today as well. If you think about the world right now, this is really what we find ourselves, is skepticism, despair, lack of alternative on the one hand, and on the other hand, authority, tradition, compliance, conformity, following a pattern.
Part of the reason we follow a pattern, though, is that we are part of nature and nature has patterns. And so we are part of that. And we are the creatures who can understand that. So presumably animals can't. Animals follow these patterns, but they don't know that's what they're doing. But if you know that you're following a pattern, that's also the thing that allows you to exercise your discretion not to follow a pattern. But we struggle with that all the time, too. We simultaneously probably overstate the extent to which it's us making up our own minds. You know, I'm voting this way because I'm a free person and I get to exercise my choice. And oh, look, I voted like all the people in Yeovil or wherever it is, even though I've never met them. And I think I'm a different person. I'm a free, independent person, but I am actually conforming to a pattern. And so isn't part of the project also that in each case, so we can overstate the extent to which we are free in that first sense, that we are just an individual, an autonomous individual making up our own mind, because we're not. We're part of a whole set of natural patterns in the natural order of the world. And at the same time, we can overstate the extent to which we're part of the natural order of the world because we're human. And to be human is different from just being part of all of the rest of nature.
I think what is really, really interesting about the way in which this kind of Kantian project developed is it starts with this idea that we are part of a pattern, but on the other hand, we are also the source of the patterns that we identify in nature, because the concept of a scientific law wouldn't be there without a mind, without a reason that tries to think about, okay, how do we structure these phenomena that we find in nature. And in a way, the whole Kantian project is to try and bring the scientific revolutions of the 17th century, Copernicus, into philosophy, into the world of social science, into the world of human relations, by saying, yes, there are all these things that we find, there are these phenomena in nature, but without a mind that grasps these phenomena, without us being able to analyze and understand them and distinguish them and say, this is a generalization, this is contingent, this is necessary. All these decisions that we make are all part of our reason. And it's because we have this capacity for reason and this ability to think about the law that we then try and find what is the law in all the structures that we are part of. Science, nature, observation of the world, but also our social relations. And that's not a coincidence, I think, that the whole Kantian project is about the moral law. What is the law that structures human relations, that structures human conduct? Is there something necessary and universal there, or is it just contingent, generalization, habit, convention? And obviously he challenges all that. But I think there is a sense in which it starts from this recognition of patterns and our input into patterns.
And those patterns exist across time as well as across space. So in my example, people in one part of the country turn out to be doing what people in another part of the country are doing on the same day. But also Kant believes that people a long time ago were doing things that it looked like they were doing for their own reasons. And those reasons are pretty inaccessible to us. And on his version of it, some of them are pretty primitive. And yet they are leading to something else that they can't have known about. They can't have been thinking, we're doing this because one day it'll result in the French Revolution or whatever it is. And yet we can discern some of those patterns, and it's teleological, that's his word for it. There's a direction of travel to human affairs within which human beings are both free to completely reject the teleology and to do things that make no sense in terms of an idea of progress or whatever it is. And yet, in the long run, what you get is a form of moral progress.
It's very controversial what Kant meant actually by teleology and how you think about this teleology. I personally think that the teleology is not something that you find. It's something that you reconstruct thinking about what is the type of human behavior in history and what is it driven by. And Kant thinks that it is driven by reason. It's driven by the imperatives of reason. And to the extent that you try and identify those reasons and ask yourselves, are they moral reasons or are they prudential reasons, you can tell a story that applies more generally to humans across space and time. And so you can tell a story about how they interact, and you can then have a narrative of progress or regress in history. And I think maybe this is what distinguishes Kant from some other later versions of teleology. I don't think there is anything deterministic in Kantian teleology. It's really all about how humans, as driven by reasons, act in history and in their societies, and the extent to which we can reconstruct those reasons as moral reasons and say, insofar as we see anything like something that resembles moral motives, moral imperatives, that advances our capacity for morality, we can say that there is progress. If we can't find that, then we can't say that there is progress. It's just regressive, and it's just a kind of random, arbitrary listing of events and characters, and history is just a collection of stuff that happens, but there's no philosophical history. And I think philosophical history depends on our ability to maintain firm that commitment to morality as we observe historical events unfold. And Kant thinks that what makes us human is that we are reasoning creatures. In a way, that's the difference between a human and an animal, is that we have reason and animals don't have reason. And our reason is both, as I say, a source of error, because reason gets you into all kinds of mistakes and prejudice and problems and tragedies in a way of reason. But it's also, if you are able to then reflect critically, which all of Kant's books start with a critique of pure reason, critique of practical reason, critique of judgment. If you think about the critique of reason, then you can help reason unfold in a way that is more aligned to moral commitments.
One of the patterns that, as I understand it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Kant discerns in history is that using our reason, we can all understand that it would be better for us if we got along better. You are freer, apart from anything else, if you live in a society or in a world which doesn't have conflict, doesn't have war. War is the great enemy of freedom. So best to use our reason to avoid war. And at the same time, we are drawn to conflict. And actually, many of the ways in which we exercise our reason draw us into conflict with each other, because we, not just that we don't agree about things, but we fundamentally loathe some of the things that other human beings tell us are the truth. And his term for this is unsocial sociability. That is, we're pulled in these two different directions. We're pulled towards conflict, and this connects us to Machiavelli again, but we're also pulled by our reason towards an understanding that concord or agreement would be better for us and better for the exercise of our freedom. And this is what it means to be human. I mean, this is what it means to be part of nature, but also in nature, they're not doing the reasoning bit. As reasoning creatures, we are pulled in these two different directions. And yet out of that, this is how reason ultimately leads to freedom, because out of our knowledge, our understanding that our desire for peace has to coexist with our impulse to exercise our freedom to produce conflict, we create the institutions, the rules by which we can be constrained. So it's this weird combination of what you might think of as an ideal notion of a collective good and peace, and something that's more like those philosophers of conflict, Machiavelli and Hobbes, who think that we need to be tamed, but to be a reasoning creature is to understand both those things.
Yeah, and I think what's really interesting, and that makes Kant in some ways reflecting on this issue in a way that's similar to how Christian authors thought about it, is the fact that both of these tendencies for conflict and for harmony are within reason, and they're part of the use of reason. Kant, at some point in a book called Religion Within the Limits of Reason, talks about the conflict, the fight between the evil principle and the good principle, as principles that are both part of what it means to be human, as incentives that we are both driven by. And indeed, it looks as though we wouldn't be free, we wouldn't have free will, and this is where the kind of overlap with the Christian tradition is. There wouldn't be free will if there was no possibility of error, if there was no evil, if evil was something that happens outside the mind or outside reason or outside what it means to be human. It's exactly the fact that it's part of who we are that makes it a challenge and problem to resolve, that requires being more sophisticated in how you go about thinking about. And Kant goes through different stages in his thinking. There is an earlier stage where he thinks of nature as something that could potentially help, as something like a providential intervention that prompts humans, that brings them in these conflicts. There is something that we can detect in nature, a tendency to help us resolve these conflicts and through war come to an agreement to make peace and to cooperate with each other. And I think there is a later understanding that to some extent goes along with Kant's changes in how he thought about teleology and how he thought about purposiveness more generally, both in nature and in reason, whereby he becomes much more institutionally explicit and where it's all about the kinds of politics that we have rather than the help that nature gives us in terms of resolving these conflicts and these contradictions. There's an earlier point where he thinks, well, nature is going to make us come to forms of understanding and to political institutions that will enable us to resolve our problems. And there's a later stage where he thinks, well, and usually this coincides with the French Revolution and with the impact that the French Revolution had on Kant's thinking, where he thinks, well, actually, it's when humans become their own agents, they take their fate in their own hands politically, that they then have a chance of going in a more productive, cooperative direction.
So which of those two is the more pessimistic? Because so in response to the French Revolution, Kant sees that human beings can really wrest control of this very long and complicated story. At the same time, there are lots of aspects of the French Revolution that would give one pause as to the ability of human beings to somehow naturally come to an understanding of what should happen next. And this thing can spiral out of control very, very quickly. And the danger of doing it without lots of institutional hemming in is it turns into a catastrophe.
Yeah, and that's what a lot of contemporaries of Kant, including someone like Burke, for example, thought. And that was the reason for why they were against the French Revolution, because they, exactly when people become too confident of themselves and of their own capacities to resolve problems, that they can become tyrannical and this triggers forms of domination. I think Kant thought of the French Revolution as one of the most progressive events in the history of humanity. And in particular, when he writes about this, it's not just about the French Revolution as such and the revolution as brought about by the protagonists of revolution. It's a lot about the effects that the French Revolution had on those who were watching it, even from Prussia or from outside France, basically. So not in the theater of war, not in the theater of revolution. He writes of this as one of the most progressive events in the history of humanity because he thinks that there is something tells us about our ability to observe events with impartiality. So he says the spectators to the French Revolution see people overthrowing authority, the authority of the church or of the monarchy, these institutions that they've been for centuries living under. And there is a sort of expressive element to just being able to get rid of that. And he thinks that the reaction that the French Revolution triggers of enthusiasm around those who are observing this phenomenon and wanting it to go well for the revolutionaries tells us something about our moral capacities or our moral dispositions and about the fact that there is some hope that things will go well because we have this impartial tendency to just be sympathetic to this moral happening in a way. So it's really interesting. It's not about what they do, what the French revolutionaries do, which in many ways also goes, as you say, into disaster and produces all these tragedies. It's more about how those who are outside the theater of war, the theater of revolution, think about those events and the ability to participate in them and to be interested in them, even though their interests are not at stake. The way in which politics helps us reflect about the moral structure of our moral dispositions, that is, for Kant, what is singling out this event as progressive, or as he says, as he calls it, a sign of human progress in history.
You watch the French Revolution, you watch it unfold from the outside, the initial event. Many people thought this was the great dawn of human freedom. And then you see the terror, that's one thing, and you might think that's a contingency and doesn't have to go that way. But then you see something more familiar, and certainly more familiar to anyone who'd studied human history, which was the great explosion of freedom is replaced not just by repression, but by the re-establishment of familiar patterns of political domination, from revolution to terror, but from terror to military rule, from military rule to the rise of Napoleon, to empire, to European war, and to the re-establishment then of what the other European powers felt was a more comfortable order, which then guaranteed a form of peace. But the dreams of the revolution, by that point, to a certain extent anyway, have died. So where then, if you're looking at it from the outside, do you take your inspiration for freedom? Is it that what this at least shows is that the pattern can be broken, even though in other ways the pattern reasserts itself? It reasserts itself always in a new way. Nothing saying you don't erase the French Revolution from history, even when you reassert the familiar pattern of European power structures. Is that it? Or is it the thought that next time it will be better? Or is it the thought that we could do it differently or that we've learned the lesson? Is it a lesson learning thing?
The latter for me, but to go back and I'll start with Kant and then I'll get to how I think about it. Kant didn't live to see the decline of the revolution of the Republic and the rise of Napoleon or any of that. He didn't see that. But he did live to see the terror. And it's really interesting that unlike many of his contemporaries, he was not bothered by terror. He was actually saying that some of the accounts of his contemporaries were writing about, he said, all the things that the French revolutionaries do and the terror of Jacobins and so on is nothing compared to the pressure and the tragedies that the exercise of authority before the French revolutionaries came, if you think about it in a cumulative way, produced. So, and that's really interesting because Kant was not a consequentialist. He was not into kind of weighing benefits and burdens. So it's very interesting that his contemporaries record him as saying this, that it's interesting that he has this position where he thinks there's this rupture and this fundamental moment where something happens that can't quite be accounted by moral standards, but that maybe needs to be looked at with hindsight of historical development and with a philosophical reconstruction of history.
Does that give you pause? It gives me pause. It makes me anxious about Kant.
You know, none of the philosophers that we are studying was usually a particularly nice person. Why should it give me pause? I'm sort of interested in the thought and thinking about what can I take from that. But the fact that they make particular pronouncements on any given topic of the day, they usually weren't always what we would think or hope that they would be.
I associate a sense that terror comes out in the wash of human history with many of the worst political outcomes of the politics that comes later and the great terrors of the 20th century, which, to be honest, don't really come out in the wash of human history. The millions, the many millions dead in the 20th century, in the full range of those terrors, maybe it makes me a small L liberal or small C conservative. I find it uncomfortable even starting on the road of allowing that if you take a long enough view, these horrors pale because this is your time and this is your world, and in your time and your world they don't pale.
Which is why I don't think he was grounding his defense of the French Revolution on these justifications. This is not his argument. This is something that I was saying anecdotally. He was saying to his friends who were going around and saying the Jacobins and so on. And he said, well, the institutions are right. The Republic is right. And what the church did, what the monarchy did, what the massacres of the religious wars, you have to factor all of that in. And if you think about all of those things, then maybe we need to keep a perspective in check on what we think about how we assess the Jacobins. And certainly then Kant wasn't familiar with what happened after, what kind of precedent the Jacobins set or anything like that. He just thought this is a pattern of violence that is part of human history, has always been, then was not invented by the Jacobins. For me, the interesting question is, and this is where I wanted to go back to what you said at the end, what gives me hope that things will be different? Well, I think if you have this philosophical perspective on history where you think there is a tendency to learn from one's mistakes, and we can create institutions that channel that tendency, and we can self-correct, and we do create rights and forms of protection for individuals from the abuses of authority, and we don't want to lose those, which is why I don't think we should be completely anarchist about institutions. We might want to replace them, but I don't think the replacement is arbitrary. It needs to be replaced by something that preserves the benefits of the predecessor institutions and remedies on their pitfalls. And there is a kind of learning curve there that I think should be part of how we think about politics in its relationship to morality. It's a self-correcting mechanism that, but to be able to have that, you do have to have a philosophical understanding of history. You do have to be able to create connections between our time and that time and the previous time. And so there needs to be some sense in which there is a bigger story that we can tell about how things happen and what humans do and what they don't do. If we say our time now is completely incomparable with what happened 200 years ago, or if we say, so there is a kind of temporal detachment theory where you say, you know, what happens now is completely, it's like different languages. The past is a different language and we can't understand it. Or likewise, if you say what happens in our culture is completely unintelligible to somewhere else in the world and there is no possibility of communicating, then it's not possible to have those forms of learning and it's not possible to have those means of contact. And that's why I think it's really important, and we've lost it, but it's really important to recover this philosophical perspective on history, which enables us to put together claims across time and across space with the help of something like what Kant called reason, which is the constant there and which is the universal in a way that gives you the possibility of mediating and translating between these different contextual arguments.
But in order to learn from the passage of time, you also have to have time. So Kant's very clear that this is a really messy story. The human story is messy. It has twists and turns along the way. People choose evil. They don't. There's nothing that guarantees they're going to choose good. It's sometimes catastrophic, but it tends to right itself. And each time it rights itself, there are more philosophical resources to draw on in the history of philosophy. This is the end of the 18th century, the dawn of the 19th century, and time moves at a particular rhythm. Dramatic events happen at the same time. You can recognize your world in the world of 100 years ago, and you can imagine a world 100 years to come, which is not completely removed from your world. So we're now not then. We are in the, well, not even the early 21st century anymore. It's getting on, right? Time is getting on. Last time with Machiavelli, you mentioned climate change. Climate change seems to me a good example of this, which is the temporal frame doesn't feel particularly Kantian, the twists and turns along the way. On the one hand, we're thinking about geological time, natural time, where the Anthropocene, the human story, fits into this much, much broader story, which doesn't all depend on human reason. Is human reason just another of the forces that shape the natural environment and maybe catastrophically? And then there's an urgency to it, which means if we've got to wait for the twists and turns and the catastrophes to play themselves out, it may be too late. And if people are now encouraged to think the history of philosophy over 200 years, 300 years, 2000 years will give you the resources to think about the institutional reforms that allow, we haven't got the time for that. And it may not be that we are detached from the past because we are our own people, but that we are facing challenges. Nuclear war, it seems to me, would be the other one, where political time, but also philosophical time, is now warped in ways that take it outside of the ebb and flow of Kantian reason. And I don't know what I think about that. What I think about that is that it's terrifying.
Yeah, but are you actually convinced of that? My comparison is the Lisbon earthquake at some point. These philosophers of the Enlightenment, they were hit by this event. And if you imagine a religious worldview where there is a lot of discussion around providence and does God love us or not love, the reason the Lisbon earthquake made such an impact on Enlightenment philosophers at the time was that it seemed one of these external shocks that sort of forces you to confront all the assumptions you make about the benign intervention of God or the fact that God loves humans and there seems to be all this amount of evil that's just produced out of nowhere that you can't quite account for. So they face their own catastrophic thinking, you know, their own challenges to their own thinking. And in some ways, even more than us, because they had less tools to predict events, whereas we have better science. And so we know more and that can kind of encourage catastrophic thinking, but it can also encourage a different way of looking at the future, which is to say, well, if you do certain things, then you doesn't need to happen. There's nothing inevitable because we are better equipped. We have better knowledge. We have better tools. We have better understanding of our environment. And so we are actually paradoxically more in control of nature when we know more about it than a period where people didn't have the same tools and so were much more at the mercy of the elements of external forces. So it's kind of paradoxical for me that we have this weird twist, right? When we're at the moment, we actually have more science, more capacity, more prediction, better tools. We face this catastrophic thinking that's almost worse than it was for people who didn't have any of that.
So that's my pessimistic take on this, which is that the story doesn't develop in that tension between reason as the ability that we have to understand the world better, and also reason as the thing that might drive us to do bad things. And we now understand the world much better, but we also have the capacity to do worse things. We could destroy the natural environment. I think nuclear war is nothing like the Lisbon earthquake. And I think that sort of intervention in this story, the Lisbon earthquake, certainly for the people in Lisbon, was the equivalent.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. You know, if you're a victim of, for the people who are captured, like in any conflict, in any war, it doesn't really matter how you die. If you're going to die, then for the person who dies and the person who are next to the person who dies, it really doesn't matter whether it's nuclear war or a car crash or...
No, but I'm thinking about then the possibility of the recovery as the story ebbs and flows along its way. the recovery from this. I mean, the human history is full of apocalypses for the people who live through them. In fact, that's the dominant story, I think. But out of it comes, as Kant would say, the emergence of the institutions of restraint and constraint that make these less likely, and then, using reason, something more than that, the ability of people to behave in a more moral way, all of that. I can think of 21st century scenarios where that's simply, it's not plausible that it's part of that gradual story of moral progress. I mean, it's a pessimistic view, but I don't think it's a unrealistic view that that might be what happens here. But also that tension, well, you know, let's call it unsociable sociability. Unsociable sociability in the age of climate change and nuclear war seems to me a different kind of proposition, because there are ways that the human story can go, paths that could be taken, from which there isn't an obvious coming back to a Kantian philosophy of history.
Yeah, and there is a demoralizing way and a more empowering way of looking at it. And so, in a way, the Kantian story of progress is also a story. It is a narrative. It's a story that we tell ourselves about how we can think about history. And it's premised on a certain understanding of which of the motives that shape reason will prevail, the good one or a bad one. So it will go well if people act morally. It will go badly if people don't act morally. I think the problem is that we're in the times in which we live, we have just actually lost faith in the human. So we have lost faith in our collective capacity. And that's also a story that we've told ourselves and that has taken hold of our minds. And it exercises this epistemological power. We are in its hold in the sense that we are unable. And of course, unlike people in the past who had religion as well that could sustain them, we've also lost that. So we're in a way in a world where a lot of the sources, traditional sources, we trust science, but only insofar as it goes along with this catastrophic predictive thinking. We don't really trust religion. We have really not much faith in community, and in because we're in these ultra individualistic societies where people are encouraged to fend for themselves and help themselves and don't really think about social contact. So it's, of course, it's hard because the narratives that surround us are all narratives of loss of faith in the human. And in a way, what Kant is saying in the famous essay in the Enlightenment, where he says enlightenment is the process of emerging from your own self-incurred immaturity, I think we're exactly in that type of self-incurred immaturity prediction, because you could tell the story very differently. It could go very differently. But of course, it will only go very differently if people act and mobilize and get together and try and come up with resources that encourage a different narrative to take hold. If we just all of us sit there and watch the apocalypse and think, oh, well, nothing can be done anymore. Well, yeah, it will happen. And nothing in Kant that will stop that from happening. And indeed, there's nothing Kant says that will stop that, because he's not a fool. And he doesn't say, well, it goes well. Assumption that it goes well is premised on us acting morally, and acting morally also means creating the kinds of political institutions that channel these moral incentives. And when that's not the case, then it doesn't go well. It's terrible. Nothing in nature that can help you. There's a wonderful paragraph in the Critique of Judgment where he says, nature doesn't take the human being for their special darling. It doesn't spare them pestilence or hunger or any of the things that it spares other animals. To nature, for way in which, if you just take natural perspective, we are just animals like any other animal. And yeah, of course, we'll die, we'll fight, we'll be extinct like other species of animals get extinct. What makes us a little bit different is that we have the capacity to prevent that from happening if we act in a certain way. But it does require us to act in a certain way and to think that it's possible to act in that way. So if we lose the faith in the human in that sense, then we really, there is no chance.
This is a story about freedom, and it's also a story about peace. If we do that, we can find a way towards peace in a world in which, in the political versions of this, of what it means to be human, the way it tends to go wrong is war. And war is one of the things that we can choose, not through natural impulse, but because we choose the evil, right? That's one of the things that war is, and war is evil. And it's a human choice. It's not just we suddenly become animals, we fight a war, then we become philosophers and we do peace. We're human in both of those functions of what we do. But for Kant, the arc is towards peace. And one of the things that he thought at the end of the 18th century we could learn is that war is kind of unsustainable in the long run. And one of the reasons he thought it was unsustainable, and this was a classic Enlightenment argument, it sounds quite unphilosophical, was the only way in the modern world, not in the ancient world, but in the modern world, to fund these wars was by taking out massive debts. You had to borrow to fight these wars. And he just thought this is completely unsustainable. And rational thinking human beings will notice this. It may take time. You know, you may have to fight some pretty awful wars, but then you'll twig. It's just not worth it. Even if we win, if you lose, it's definitely not worth fighting the war. But even if we win, we've won the war, but we're burdened with all this debt. In a way, we've lost our freedom because we're now in debt to the people who are our creditors. And so we will work out that the only way to maintain our freedom is to avoid this, and that will be a path to peace. And he was wrong about that. We've had this conversation before on this podcast talking about the Enlightenment, in that the most powerful states of the modern world have actually found a way to sustain that level of debt. The United States in 2024 is the single most indebted institution in human history on a scale that Kant would have thought that reasoning human beings would just no is impossible, but it's not impossible. And this is also a world in which war is not as prevalent as it's ever been, because it's less prevalent in some ways, but much more prevalent than Kant would have hoped 200 years after he wrote.
Yeah, although I don't think Kant thought that there was any, again, necessity in the disappearance of war. And in fact,
but reason would help us see it.
But it was also a political act. So the famous essay on perpetual peace, it's an essay that starts with the idea of having a clause in a peace treaty that says there shall be no war, and not a kind of temporary peace, but just a perpetual peace, a peace that lasts forever. So he was someone who said the answer to not having war is to come up with international institutions, and this famous argument about the Federation of Republican States that creates the forms of supranational cooperation that enable states to then channel their antagonisms in a direction of creating international institutions that help them coordinate. And so overcoming the standard argument in the Enlightenment was that we have the state of nature between individuals and there is the state, and that's why we have a state, because otherwise people are fighting each other. And a lot of Enlightenment critics, including Kant, took this one step further and said, well, now you have the state of nature between states, because you have these states that are now fighting each other and being like individuals in the state of nature. So how do we make sure that we have a mechanism of cooperation? And he thought that the argument for perpetual peace was exactly that kind of argument, where states are asked to stop fighting, stop funding war, stop arming themselves, basically stop doing all of the things that they're doing right now. And in fact, the motivation for that was that it's only if you create international institutions with some power over these individual states that you can create forms of sustainable cooperation that don't need to trigger constant conflicts. And this is why it's an argument, not just for peace, but for perpetual peace, which is much more demanding in a way, but I think also more promising, because without perpetual peace, there's always have war here and there and conflicts tend to erupt. Interestingly, this project for perpetual peace, which was not, again, not something that Kant came up with, it was in, Rousseau mentioned it, it was in Saint-Pierre, included Russia, included a proposal for a federation of European states, but with a very large, expansive geography, had clauses for what to do with the Ottoman Empire, because there was always a question of, you know, the Christians versus the others and so on. But it was very visionary for the time, and in some ways, something that should still be an inspiration for how we think about institutions nowadays.
I still think there's a problem with that Enlightenment view that you can take the next step. So the first step for unsocial sociability is from human conflict to the institutions of the state. And then these states are in conflict and you take the next step, which is to the institutions that these states then are constrained by, but also within which they can exercise their freedom of choice. And I think the flaw with that is that the states aren't human. And they are not human in lots of ways, including they don't reason like human beings do. They reason like machines. I've always thought that this is the fundamental flaw with that whole view of the world. And part of my evidence for that is that Kant was wrong about debt. So on a human level, that relationship between war and debt is unsustainable. It doesn't make any sense, but it makes perfectly good sense for these machines, which turn out to be, among other things, debt servicing machines that give human beings faith that actually perpetual indebtedness is the story of the modern human condition. And out of perpetual indebtedness, the United States is the classic example of this. Out of perpetual indebtedness, what you get is lots of good things for human beings, economic growth and the rest, but you don't get the end of conflict because debtor-creditor relationships are inherently unstable, and then debt is the engine of war.
I think you're right that Kant didn't see that, but other people did see that. Someone like Fichte, for example, who was a Kantian in many ways, actually when he wrote one of his books, everyone thought it was Kant. He published anonymously and everyone thought it was Kant. And so he was kind of nurturing his inner Kant, even though he ended up in a very different place from Kant's perpetual peace, because he ended up with the celebration of the state and what he calls a closed commercial state. But in a way, this argument about debt, the unsustainability of debt and so on, what exactly led him to argue that we need to do something about not just what the states do, but about globalization more generally. And his answer was, well, since we can't do anything about globalization, then we just go back to the closed commercial state and stop interacting and somehow deglobalize. And so then there's a whole debate that follows from there. Fichte was one...
Which is also quite contemporary.
Quite contemporary, right? So Fichte was one answer. Another argument was then Hegel and Marx, which is a different way of thinking about it, which is, well, why don't you, instead of putting all the emphasis on debt, think about, well, where is debt coming from? And what is the structure of our economic relations? And we'll talk in the future about this, have this discussion around the market and the relationship of markets to the state. But basically, the argument was then a reform, not just of the state, but also of the environment, the economic environment within which states operate, and that's something that will then enable states to be better at creating peace without these constraints on them, which are in some ways external and constraints of the market rather than produced by the states.
You could say one of the reasons that we've lost our faith in the human is that human reason has turned out to be remarkably good at building artificial agents, artificial decision makers, including rational decision makers on a mechanistic understanding of rationality, that are the dominant forces in our world, that the state is not simply an expression of human reason for better and for worse, good or evil. It is its own thing. And that our world is dominated by these vast entities, which are their own thing. And they are the products of human reason, and they are motivated by what the human beings who build them want to happen, but they also acquire a kind of life of their own. And the other way in which we may not have much time is that this process is really rapidly accelerating, that human reason, coupled now with the reasoning capacity of so-called intelligent machines, artificially intelligent machines, is at rapid pace creating new kinds of decision-making entities, which again suggests to me that what you need in the Kantian story, which is the sort of back and forth, the weft and waft, or whatever the phrase would be of the story of human reason, that story, maybe I've lost faith. That story is over.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. In part because I think maybe we actually have a disagreement in terms of how we think about the autonomy of these artificial agents. So I think maybe, I suspect you think of them as much more autonomous than I think they are from human reason. I think they track human reason. It's just that they track a non-moral side of human reason. So they track a kind of instrumental reason that is prudential in many ways, but isn't always kind of thinking about morality and moral imperatives and so on. But that's, I don't think there's anything essential about that. They don't need to be doing that. They can be designed in different ways. And we do have agency, and these are still connected to us, these institutions that we create, these artificial agents. It's still fundamentally human reason that is at their basis. They channeled human reason differently in different historical periods, and because of the constraints and because of the environment in which they operate, they might be different. But I don't think there's anything essential about this loss of control, which is also partly why I'm, I think, more optimistic and not completely despairing, because I think, well, they now reflect what the zeitgeist is, and so they reflect the dominant tendencies. But these are tendencies. There is nothing essential about them. There's nothing deterministic. And because we are free and we could be different. And I think if we concede that humans are free, we have to also concede that they could be different. And we also have to concede that there's nothing predetermined about the way they operate and what they create produces.
I want to ask you about one last idea of freedom, which is essentially Kantian, which is intellectual freedom. So in the essay about enlightenment, it's also about what it is to live in a world where it is absolutely crucial that people are able to voice dissenting opinions at the same time as it is also important that you don't descend into anarchy. So to summarize it too crudely, essentially what Kant is saying is that at a certain level, you must abide by the rules of your state, but you also must be willing to criticize them. That's quite Machiavellian in a way. It's also quite Socratic or Platonic. You know, we've been talking about different versions of this, the dilemma of what we call democracy, but other people would call republican forms of government, which is you both need to be a good citizen and a dissenting citizen. But Kant's version of it is very much an intellectual version in the sense that he's imagining what he calls a republic of letters, and he's imagining what we would probably think of as something close to the academic version of this, that there are settings in which dissent is not just to be encouraged, it's absolutely essential among the people who are understood as the thought leaders and the ones who are communicating to a literate public in a world where most people were not literate. And so it exists within a particular setting. And within that setting, you can have radical intellectual freedom because it's unlikely to leak out into a world in which it would lead to people no longer obeying the law. And that also feels to me quite, let's say, 19th century, late 18th, 19th century, and through to ideals of university and educated life in the 20th century, doesn't feel to me very 21st century in the age of the kind of information space that we live in now, the ways in which it's been radically democratized, in which the expression of dissent and of different opinions has spread way beyond the Republic of Letters. Or maybe we're all now in the Republic of Letters, I don't know. But it's not that Kantian version in which part of what makes it work is that you can move between these two spaces where it's radical freedom of dissent and intellectual dissent within a relatively stable political space. I don't feel that's our world.
So yes and no, this very interesting discussion. I always have this discussion with my students, discussion around the Enlightenment and how you think about the public sphere and the extent to which our public sphere or the digital public spheres that we have, the extent to which they overlap or differ from these Enlightenment public spheres. And I think there is a sense in which the predicament is not that different, in that what Kant is saying is if you're in a particular social role, if you're a doctor or a tax collector or an administrator or whatever, you just have to perform within the constraints of that role, because otherwise, you know, you can't be a conscientious objector in every type of function that you perform, right? So if you have to teach certain things, you have to teach certain things. You can't just go around tell the students what your opinions are on everything you teach, even though you might have an opinion on everything. And that applies to, again, to being a doctor, to being an engineer, to whatever, being an administrator, being a tax collector. So in that sense, I think we are still in a society where there is division of labor and where all of us are performing certain social roles. But then we also have something like the ethics of the citizen, where we can step out of our social role and criticize the constraints of that role, the way in which those roles function. And in that sense, it's quite similar. What I think is different, and I think you're completely right about that, is that we have a notional expansion of a public sphere, in that for Kant, it was basically just educated bourgeois and aristocratic men. And, you know, there were no women, there were no sense of people without property who would be included in the public sphere and so on. And so in a way, formally, right now, we have a much more expansive public sphere and the more potential for emancipation also, because it's much more, the discourse could take on, could be wider. But oddly, there's also something else that happens, which is then the pressure of conformity. And so in our contemporary public sphere, there is, yes, possibly lots of ideas circulating and so on. But in practice, what you have is highly disciplined currents of thought and thought bubbles where you have everyone agreeing within the thought bubble and very little then transfer from one bubble to the other and very little exchange between those. And then it becomes, again, like the Kantian context in which he's saying, well, you need to be able to step out of now not just the role obligations, but also the thought bubbles, where then the Enlightenment argument, I think, becomes still really relevant, because it is an argument for exercising reason in an open way. And Kant doesn't say, you know, just exercise reason. There are constraints of how you exercise reason. It's not just that we reason, but there you have to reason in a way that puts you in a place of everyone else. You have to think consistently. There is what Kant calls the maxims of enlightened thinking. And so it's not just anything goes. And then you discipline your conversations. And then you're able, within those constraints of reason, to have conversations across these different bubbles. And that is what might encourage the public sphere to operate. But just the existence of the public sphere and just the openness is not going to be enough, because there are many different ways, including in contemporary societies, in which thought is disciplined by commerce, by incentives, by advertising, by propaganda, or by the sheer pressure of conformity with your peers.
It's also about time. The Kantian Republic of Letters moved at a relatively sedate pace. You had the time to think. You had the time to respond. If there was going to be progress in this world, everyone understood it would take a lot of time. Progress in philosophy. Now, we are moving in a particular direction, but it takes time. We don't have that time now. And then, you know, when Elon Musk bought Twitter and then he called it X, the phrase he used, he said, "I'm buying the global public square. That's what I'm doing." And for this to work now, because it's become so conformist and it's become so regulated, we have to open it up. We've got to let Donald Trump back in. You know, we have to break up these bubbles. But you know, it's frankly been a disaster, I think. And it's been a disaster because it is just the unregulated version of it, for the reasons you said, just create new kinds of patterns of domination.
Yeah, they do. But I don't think the problem is time. The problem is education.
Well, education takes time.
Right, but I think that we have to go back to the source. What is the issue there? If you have a very educated public, because a lot of people tend to assume that one of the questions with digital interactions and digital media is everything is like so superficial and so quick, and then there's not enough time to think. But if people were highly educated, the fact that it's quick could also be an advantage, because then we could have an argument really quickly and then resolve it and then move to the next argument, then we'd have a lot more knowledge. So I think there is a different way of seeing it, which is the reason it's now producing the worst pathologies is this quickness and the pressure and the urgency combined with fundamental ignorance. But the fundamental ignorance, again, is not essential. It's driven by the way in which education works and education institutions are funded and who gets to benefit and who doesn't. So then we go back to all these discussions around access to education and what it takes to think intellectually and critically.
I completely understand what you just said, and I can picture it as an ideal. The quick argument that produces the answer more quickly and allows us to move on. We now live in a world where that kind of speed has been franchised out to machines. It just has, and I don't think it's coming back. That kind of knowledge, the ability to access this space so that you can move in time with the pace of the information, is so reliant now on machines, which are themselves controlled by and dominated by the forces that you just talked about. And I don't think, my feeling is that this has escaped the story that we've talked about, which through the 20th century did make a lot of sense. We have escaped it. And part of the reason that we've escaped it, I totally also get what you're saying, that it's tracking one version of human reason. But that version of human reason that it is tracking has now acquired a life of its own.
Fine, it has escaped. Is the escape irreversible or not? Because if you think it's irreversible, okay, fine, let's close down the podcast, go home, get drunk, and wait for everyone to die. If you're saying it's reversible, the next question is, what are you doing to reverse it? And that's the question that people need to ask themselves. It's no point just going around everyone beating each other up and saying, oh, it's so terrible, it's escaped, it's out of control. These machines, they are designed by humans, and we know they have all the biases of humans, because you go and you ask them certain kinds of questions and they regurgitate back all the biases, which shows that there is a kind of design flaw. They could be designed differently, yes or no? Yes. If they could be designed differently, what are we doing to design them differently? It's very simple. Who are you voting for? Who are you campaigning for? What are you saying? What kind of arguments are you making? We all have individual responsibilities in upholding the kind of social structures that make up our lives. And it's just, we don't get out of them by just saying it's so terrible, we can't do anything. Because actually, we can do something, all of us.
Do subscribe now to PPF Plus, where you can get ad-free listening, no ads on past or future episodes of this podcast, and you get 2 bonus episodes to accompany every series that we put out. Coming soon to accompany this series, there'll be an episode in which Leia and I talk about what freedom means in the age of thinking machines and AI. To get PPF Plus, just click on the link that comes with the show description or go to ppfideas.com. You can, as always, follow us on Twitter at PPF Ideas, on Instagram and TikTok, and there are videos. Coming up next on the History of Freedom in episode 5, we're going to be talking about the idea of the free market. Just how free are we when we're buying, when we're selling, when we're borrowing, when we're spending? Do join us for that. This has been Past, Present, Future, brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.